Welcome to the Kingdom Crossroads Podcast with Pastor Robert Thibodeau. Using an interview format, Pastor Bob will introduce you to men and women whose ministries are impacting this world with the gospel, and will also provide commentary and insight on end-time prophetic events we now see happening in the news. Now here is Pastor Robert Thibodeau.
Hello everyone everywhere. This is Pastor Robert Thibodeau. Welcome to another episode of a dual broadcast for Kingdom Crossroads Podcast and everything church related. And we are so blessed to have back on the line the real life Indiana Jones, Stan Dale, calling all the way in from Colorado. Stan, how are you doing today?
Very good. Thank you, Pastor Bob. I have been keeping busy with more videos and YouTube stuff. I just finished putting up some on President Trump's uncle. Did you see that one?
I haven't seen that one yet. No, was that? I understand you had an interview with President Trump's uncle. This is a long time ago. It's not like it happened, you know, like last week. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. Yeah, that was in 1982. Yeah, and it was with Dr. John Trump, who was President Donald Trump's uncle.
Okay.
And he and Dr. Trump just were famous friends. I mean, Dr. Trump was probably his mentor on so many levels, it's not funny. And, you know, John Trump, Professor Trump, he'd worked on nuclear stuff for the government, and he was just really way up the line of trusted and secured, you know, people in the government at the end of World War II. Anyway, 1983. I was in Perth, Australia at that time, and a film company over on the other side of Australia in Queensland wanted to do a documentary on my work on Nikola Tesla, and they wanted to film it.
And the guy who invented the Tesla automobile or the technology for it?
Well, some of the technology. Nikola Tesla was a Yugoslav. He called himself a Serbo, a Serbo creation. Mm-hmm. Get it in a minute. Serbo Croatian. They didn't like to be called Yugoslav, but anyway, he was born in Serbia and eventually moved to the United States in, the late 1800s, and he developed the first alternating current generator. Before that time, it was only like the Edison direct current generators, and they were highly inefficient as far as transmitting power across the country at any distance. Anyway, he went to work for Mr. Edison, and Edison joked with him, saying paying $50,000 if he could get a AC generator, because something like that couldn't be invented. They figured it was impossible. So Tesla went off into the back room, and over a few weeks of working there, he came back one morning and showed it to Mr. Edison. He said, look, here's the AC alternating current generator you said couldn't be built, and he proved it to him. And he said, now I'll have my $50,000. And Mr. Edison said, boy, you don't understand American humor. That was just a joke, you know. And so Tesla picked up his alternating current generator, walked out the door and quit, went to work somewhere else. Actually worked in construction for a while, shoveling dirt until he could get money together to make his own company.
Hmm.
But he ended up having over 900 patents to his name. He is the father of all high voltage engineering, you know, and distribution of power that we use in the world, for that matter. He was the first person to make electricity from in New York at the New York World's Fair from the dam right there next to New York, the huge dam.
Okay.
What's it called?
I'm not sure.
Oh no, you know. Anyway, he harnessed the power of this of the waterfalls there at the dam, and lit the World's Fair.
You're talking about the Niagara Falls.
Yes, I am. Niagara Falls. Yeah, okay. Old age, I admit. Anyway, he got with Westinghouse, and Westinghouse gave him a contract to build the first alternating current generators, and they were run by the waterfalls there at Niagara. And he lit up the World's Fair, and after that, everybody wanted alternating current electricity in their homes. And he was the father of most electricity that we use worldwide now. Okay, now that's Tesla. And he was an eccentric. He was a brilliant, like a savant almost, researcher. And he, in about 1943, I think in January, is when he died. And he died broke. He tore up a contract between him and Westinghouse. Westinghouse had promised him $1 for every horsepower used, and you know, with his generators and all that kind of stuff, and $250,000, and in those days was a lot of money. And you know, Westinghouse got in trouble financially. He couldn't honor the $1 per horsepower and still distribute power and beat Edison. So Tesla just tore up the contract right in front of Mr. Westinghouse, and he says, "Hey, you're my friend. I'm not going to have your business go broke. You're relieved from your contract." And of course, he handed over gazillions of dollars in essence. And it didn't matter to him. It was the invention, you know, the process that he was worried with. But anyway, when he died in 1943, Tesla was in a room in the hotel there in New York, obviously. And the thing was that when he died, he had left a package wrapped in brown paper down in the lobby of the hotel, and tied up with string and stuff. And he told the staff, "Don't ever open this. This is a secret to, you know, a world-destroying weapon." And so he put it up there as surety against the back rent he owed, which was considerable. And they put it in the safe there at behind the desk, and that was it. Now, and then, of course, he was dead in 1943. Well, everyone was afraid to open up the package. They were afraid that it would blow up in her face or something. So the FBI, these brave FBI agents, they got a hold of Professor John Trump, and they said, "Look, you're expert. You know, you're cleared security wise, whatever. You're expert in high voltage. You started high voltage engineering there in Boston. Why don't you come over here and help us open up this mystery package that Mr. Tesla left behind?" So they get over to the hotel. And if you look at the Hotel New York, I've got a picture of it there on the video, you can see. You'll see that the hotel has a lobby and big marble pillars up next to the lobby, to the desk, and then across an open space with chairs, and then some more big marble pillars. He said, "Well, these brave FBI agents, they went over and stood behind the farthest pillars they could and said, 'Now you go ahead and open it.'" The staff cleared out, everybody cleared out and left John there, you know, with this package. And so he said, "Well, okay, I'm dying to know what this man left behind," because he was really famous by that time. So Professor Trump takes out his knife and he runs it around trying to find any metal wires or hidden things. It's just string. So he cuts the string. Then he feels under the paper and all around the sides to feel any bulges or anything. There was nothing. So then he opens up this package, is wrapped in brown paper, and folds it out. And here before him is this beautiful hand-rubbed, like mahogany box with brass handles and a brass latch on the front. So again, he looked around the edge of the lid and see if there was any kind of sensors or things there. Lifted it with his knife very slowly and peeked under it. There was nothing there. So then he opened it all the way up. And here this secret weapon was. And all it was, as far as he was concerned, and the FBI, was what's called a Wheatstone bridge or a decade resistance box. It was the ancestor of a multimeter that you measure resistance with. Okay. Anyway, he says, "Well, there was no message in there, and that was it." And so off camera, while I was interviewing there in Boston, I said, "Dr. Trump," I said, "do you realize that the message was the box itself? He was telling you, if you studied his work, that the way to make a weapon that could break the earth in half is to build an impedance-matching thump, or, you know, something to create a regular pattern that's in harmony with the atmosphere, or with the earth, or whatever." I said, "He made an earthquake machine that darn near destroyed his lab and several buildings in New York years ago, just with an air pressure hose and a cylinder and a piston inside. They had to hit it with a sledgehammer to break it because it wouldn't stop working. It was causing an earthquake around the city."
Wow.
So he was talking about, he was talking about making harmonic energy. And, of course, he's most famous in the kind of, you know, amateur scientific community for making the Tesla coil, which allows you to put in, say, a neon transformer, 12,000 volts, put it into a couple of coils and some stuff you put together like he did, and out the top will come millions of volts, you know, arcs stretching, you know, 10, 15 feet. And because they're at high frequency, you can let it run through your body and it won't hurt you.
Yeah, I remember those balls in high school physics class.
Yeah, well, I used to, I built one of these for the Science Museum down in Perth when I was down there, and one of my favorite tricks before I got it inside the Faraday cage we had to build for safety for their occupant, or for their guests and stuff, I brought the Oh, the lady in charge of the museum and two or three of the guys that worked for her over various departments to my house where I was building this thing in the garage. And I took up a little metal thimble, you know, sewing thimble, and put it on my finger. And I put one hand on top of the coil that was emitting these huge arcs. And I pointed my other hand up in the air, and you could see arcs dancing off my finger into the air. And then I pointed at a block of wood and caught the block of wood on fire with the current coming out of my finger.
Oh, wow.
And they were greatly impressed. And I said, well, look, it's just high frequency. It's skin effect. It won't kill you. Come on up here and do this. All three guys went, oh, no, I couldn't do it. No, I'm afraid. The woman came up, and she did it. And I was really amazed by that. And I said, well, see there, I told you it wouldn't hurt you. But anyway, that's Tesla. And wow. He invented so many things. It's just unbelievable. Worked in free energy. You know, he was doing research and collecting solar energy straight out of the atmosphere, which mm-hmm. is something that, of course, I've picked up, and so did a guy named Dr. T. Henry Murray later. But anyway, John George Trump, was the electrical engineer in charge of opening that secret, and that's what wow. I put in the interview because, of course, he's now passed on, but he was playing with the secret to unlimited free energy from the sun and didn't realize it at the time.
Wow. Amen. Amen. Glory to God. I got another question for you.
You're full of questions.
Oh, I know. I think that's my job. But
all right.
One of the things that we discovered as we were preparing for these interviews was that you did some work for the government down in Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Good research. I can tell you quite a bit about that. There are probably some things that I won't
make public. We can do part 4 and 5. I don't care.
Well, that's...
And we won't tell anybody else. It's just you and me. You
know, and thousands of listeners, I know. I guess I was recruited in 1971, when I lived in Dallas, I was recruited to join Dr. Edward Teller's research project down in Australia. It's a longer story to tell how I was discovered, in essence, by by Teller's group. Mm-hmm. But anyway, suffice it to say that I was discovered working on anti-gravity and flying saucer technology and alternate energy from the atmosphere. And I was doing it in my home as a hobby. And so somehow or another, the powers that be, let's call them, did find out and did approach me to join forces with them, work for them down in Australia with Dr. Teller's group. Now,
let me stop you right there. So you were doing this on your own, off-grid.
Yep.
And they still found out about it and decided that your research was advanced enough that they wanted to join forces with you.
Yes. In the interview process, I discovered that they had already surpassed what I was doing in their own research okay. in the United States and in, West Germany underground and in Norway and in Canada and in Australia and New Zealand. They had places everywhere working on this.
Wow.
And they already had anti-gravity. They'd already built the kind of ship I was first going to build, which is what's called a plasma dynamic craft, and it's a flying saucer that ionizes charged air and shoots it up out underneath a lid on top of a disc-shaped craft and over the edge of the lid and then back underneath to distribute the charges back into the plasma generator. Anyway, that kind of an aircraft they had already had trouble with, and I would have found out eventually, but the seals they were using up around the top to seal in the rest of the craft from the hot, you know, chamber that ionized the air would catch fire frequently. And when it did, because these things use a breaststroking pattern of this charged air around the craft, it would trap all the smoke and blind the craft and the pilot and stuff. They couldn't see through the smoke. And so, and that was one of the problems. One of the other problems was these things would go so fast, so much faster than a jet aircraft, that when you turn corners, it presented a problem to the craft and the occupants. The G-forces were enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had to get to a different place. And in the mid-50s to late 50s, somewhere in that region, they did discover how to make anti-gravity craft that actually generated their own gravitational field, and you could accelerate the craft at high speeds, you know, 20,000 miles an hour in the atmosphere, and then turn a corner at 90 degrees and not even spill a drop of tea if you were drinking it when you turned the corner.
Wow.
It's inertial physics. It doesn't violate anything that Einstein talked about. It's just simply amortizing the corner turn over a second or two versus doing it in a millionth of a second, which would kill you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, long story. So they sent me down there, and my control officer down there was Captain Sir John Williams in Melbourne, who was also knighted by the Queen of England during World War II for recovering a bunch of gold bullion in a sunken ship off the coast of New Zealand. Mm-hmm. At that time, he was probably in his, 70s, I guess. Tall, naval seafaring captain-looking guy, you know, straight as a board when he stood up. But anyway, he was my contact there, and I was asked to write a couple of papers on where I was in my research. And in doing so, the first paper I presented, he says, can I take this and show it to my my professors on the trip to Jakarta next week? I said, yeah, fine. And then he asked me to rewrite it and leave out some of the suggestions I'd put in there about sharing this technology with underdeveloped countries to keep them from starving or keep them from dehydrating, by giving water, pumping water with these devices that take energy out of the atmosphere. And also being able to ship food back and forth at high speeds with these craft. He said, no, that strikes a discordant note with me and one of my other associates here in charge of the scientific organization for Australia, the CSIRO. He says, take out all that part about how you want to use this for this and that. And,
for the benefit of mankind.
Yeah, no, we're not releasing that stuff. Yeah. And I said, well, why not? And over a few weeks, we kind of got into a little bit of a disagreement, he and I, and about that. And so eventually, 1973, 74, I'd only been there a couple of years, he decided to terminate my participation in the project and sent a number of files to me with his chauffeur to my front door and said, burn these or do whatever you want. We're disappearing all knowledge of you in our office. Mm. And so they did do that. Now, I found out later it wasn't all antagonistic. What had happened was we had underground research facilities all over the planet, and some underwater, some under land, and they were built in conjunction with what the uneducated would simply call aliens, or people that weren't from Earth. Mm-hmm. Some looked like us. Some were robotic things, like little gray critters that were just biological robots, soulless type, emotionless type things that performed duties for them. Anyway, these guys in the early 50s had made a deal, apparently, with us to have us build underground facilities for them, and inside these facilities to build manufacturing complexes that would make technology they needed to do what they wanted as far as settling in on our planet and blah, blah, blah. Well, that worked until the middle 70s, 74, 75 is when it started to happen, because Sir John had actually mentioned this at lunch one day with myself and him and Sir Henry at the Melbourne Club, and he was talking about they were moving in and we were losing, and I didn't know who he was talking about at the time, but it was these alien critters. Mm-hmm. Now, in biblical speak, I think those are Satan's fallen angels, and perhaps Satan himself involved in it. They were arriving here, just popping into our atmosphere, and from their parallel universe, if you wish. Now, these guys finally reached a point where they didn't need humans' help to build infrastructure for them to go and do what they needed, basic manufacturing. Now, you can imagine if the American military, let's say, and scientists got transported over to a remote desert island that had palm trees and natives but nothing else, right, and were told you need to survive here and you couldn't take much technology with you, so you had to take what you could carry on your back and get the natives to build you something to help you build much more advanced technology, like waterfalls and that kind of stuff. Well, that's the same kind of parallel to these beings coming here. And a lot of the information is leaked out into the the amateur press, if you wish, some of it's fake news, but in essence, what they were talking about is taller humans, slightly taller than we are, with with DNA that made their skin have little scales, little tiny scales on it, so in the sunlight it looked like an oil sheen, just rainbow effects. You could turn their hands. Okay. Now, I didn't see that. I was simply told that at my briefing. Mm-hmm. But it made sense. And, of course, they were using these gray robotic small ones and tall ones to do a DNA collection they wanted across the planet, because they were after more than just infrastructure to build, you know, weapons and stuff. They were after DNA from critters, you know, cows, people, whatever, that lived well and adapted to the human ecosystem. And they wanted to take that DNA and build an empty shell, if you wish, of a being, and that they could then put intelligence into, transfer, you know, consciousness into, so they had a body in this world. Mm. Not a clever thing to do, but still that's what they're trying to do. So anyway, in the mid-70s, we were... our project was kicked out of all the bases at once. There was a number of firefights and some continuing aggro between us and them. But in essence, all the technology we use now is subject to their control, the advanced technology stuff. Mm-hmm. Before they, you know, pull the plug on us, it was thought that we would keep all this secret until a time in the near future at that time where the Earth could be brought to the edge of nuclear war and food shortages could be amplified in the press, in the fake press, and so fake that the fake news, that's right, so that the people of Earth would be panicked into thinking we were going to have the one or more of the crisis curves was going to kill the planet, and they would be looking for someone or something to help them. And that's when they planned to announce the arrival of Elder Brothers from space, you know, put the Elder Brothers in air quotes, and that these beings would obviously be more advanced than humans are. The common people would think that. And the common people would think, okay, they're not Buddhist, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jew. They're just whatever they are out there. And obviously they have a solution because here they are traveling from their world to ours, mm-hmm. all friendly. And so, you know, when they offer to help us, it's like the movie V was, where these... Right. And that movie was so well done. Anyway, you had these aliens coming in that movie, and they had skins that looked human on the outside, but inside they were really reptilian creatures. So right. It was a play on what the Bible does say about Satan being, you know...
Well, not only that, but when you were talking about the scaling effect on their skin... that's what I was thinking of, was that movie as well.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's, you know, I forget the guy's name that wrote the series. I did try to contact him a number of times to tell him that he did such a wonderful job in bringing the biblical prophecies of what's about to happen mm-hmm. into a fictional storyline. They end up killing the aliens in his
right.
books by having a distilled blood. It's a hybrid of an off-world reptilian creature and a human. Not exactly how the Bible tells it, but still, it's the dried blood that they spread around the planet and runs off all the reptilian alien creatures. Very similar to, of course, the blood of Jesus being right. used to defeat him. But we were working, you know, in essence, with these critters to develop this stuff. And after I was dismissed, I was approached within several weeks by a group of prominent businessmen there in Melbourne. One of them was, I think, the president of a large insurance company's real-world job. And they were offering me a laboratory to continue my research, but apart from the group. And I was having a long lunch, and they plied me with a nice bottle of wine, and I said, look, we're going to go 60 miles north here and give you a laboratory underground. You can't tell anybody about this. Obviously, it'd be secret, but we know that your antenna you're working on requires, you know, several thousand feet straight up, but we thought it would work if we put you down in a mine shaft and you just ran the wire up the shaft. And I said, yeah, I probably would. And he said, well, we'll set you up and put your lab down at the bottom of the mine shaft in the Ballarat gold fields. Mm. Ah, and even with a bottle of wine in me, I was thinking, tell no one, go work at the bottom of a mine shaft with only one way out. No,
what,
okay.
What could happen here?
Yeah, so that night, I'd already been thinking about hitting the road anyway. That night, I made plans to come to work at a friend's place and park my car out the back, and at about midnight when it's dark, have all my stuff there that I was going to be able to take with me in a duffel bag and hit the road. So I did, and it took me a few months to cross the Nullarbor Desert. I crossed the whole country with a group of hippies that I teamed up with, so that no one knew, you know, where it was or who it was. Changed my name, and that was the beginning of hiding and running. And I had FBI, I had Vatican intelligence, ASIO, Australian intelligence. I had three or four intelligence agencies trying to find me for at least 6 months. They couldn't locate me. But they did eventually catch me. And fortunately, I'd gone to West Australia, where I had friends I didn't know about in the intelligence world. And they protected me over there. And that's the reason I lived to tell the story.
Because they were looking to eliminate you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, look, just before I came out of the desert with those hippies, we were parked one night not far from the dirt road, that the main dirt road going across the desert. And we had a campfire lit, and we're having our coffee and had finished dinner. And we could see off in the distance, because out there it's a flat, you can see cars coming for a long way away. This light, you know, headlights of a car kept coming and coming and coming, came right over to us, pulled up, stopped, and got out. And there's one man, and he kind of looked like he knew karate. I mean, he was pretty pretty healthy guy. Anyway, he came over, and he talked to us. Said, could he have some coffee? Yeah, sure. And he comes and sits right by me on the log I was sitting on. And I thought, well, that's strange, but okay. So everybody's talking, and the rest of the crew out there, they were dope smokers, so they were lighting up their weeds. And he leaned over to me in my ear, and he says, I know who you are. Your real name is blah, blah, blah. And I said, uh-huh. And he says, we've been looking for you. I was actually sent to dispose of you. And I thought, holy cow. And, you know, and I just kind of held my breath waiting for where I could jump or do to get out of his way. And he says, but relax. I'm going to tell him I didn't find you and let you go. And I have no idea to this day why he did, but he was a Jesuit intelligence officer. And I only saw him one other time after that when I got to Perth. But yeah, so they were interested in being sure I didn't tell the rest of the story.
So with sharing this now, is it because the classification wore off, or enough information has come out, or how does that work?
You know, I've often wondered that. We came back to the States in 2001. I was allowed to come back and have my passport returned and my citizenship returned. They'd taken all that away from me to keep me in Australia.
Wow.
And it took a call from former Secretary of Defense Jim Schlesinger before they would release all that stuff and let me back in, which he did do. Now, I thought it's going to be interesting to see if the plane blows up on the way over there, or if we have an accident after the fact. And that was, what, 15 years ago, still here. So, you know, the good Lord has looked after us. I don't know why they did that and didn't harm me, but, you know, as far as I know, I have no classifications, security classifications, or a hit out on me at the moment. I've never had any problems since I've been back.
Well, that's a good thing.
Join us next time as we continue our discussion with Sam Dale.
Are you a Christian entrepreneur, coach, or author with a message that needs to be heard? Picture this: your voice reaching thousands, your story inspiring hearts, and your business flourishing like never before. Introducing Faithcasters, the ultimate platform that connects faith-driven professionals like you with the power of podcasting. Become a sought-after guest on Faith-Based Podcast. Share your unique insights and connect with like-minded individuals who share your passion for faith and entrepreneurship as well. Imagine your expertise reaching a wider audience, expanding your network, and propelling your business to new heights. Well, it's all within reach with Faithcasters. So don't wait. Take the first step today on your journey to greatness by visiting our website at faithcaster.org. That's faithcaster.org. Join the Faithcasters community now and unleash the full potential of your faith-driven enterprise. You do not want to miss this opportunity. Faithcasters, where faith meets podcasting and your dreams become reality. Visit faithcaster.org. Let's soar together. And remember, anyone can be a podcaster, but only a Christian can become a faithcaster. Faithcasters, your voice, your platform, your success.